Hello, I'm Chris LeBlanc. This is number 0601, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0601. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Melanie Lentz, who became a Secret Service agent at the age of 22. She's the author of Agent Innocent. The Secret Service doesn't have a lot of women.
My academy class of 24 had three total female agents, me and two other women who are both a lot older than me and both had military or law enforcement experience, and one of them had both, actually. But the Secret Service actually didn't start hiring female agents until the early 70s. And even today, there's mostly a one female agent to every 9 or 10 male agents. So it's still, even today, very, very male-dominated occupation for sure.
Author Dennis Palumbo, who is also a psychotherapist who specializes in dealing with writers and creative types. How has the pandemic period been for them?
Over the years, I've had so many patients say to me, boy, if I ever just had some time off, I would sit down and write my magnum opus. And yet, since the lockdown, they've been paralyzed and have not written anything due to a number of factors. Number one, the anxiety about the pandemic and the uncertainty. And people handle uncertainty in different ways. But on the other hand, I have writers who have found that their workload is increased. They actually enjoy the constriction of the lockdown.
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back with a February story about the great race of 1908.
And this was really quite a race. It was going from New York City to Paris, so around the world. And this was going to start in Times Square. Keep in mind, it's 1908. Cars are pretty much in their infancy still. And it was going to be a 20,000-mile route. Obviously, we're heading west. There were not that many roads, which added to the challenge.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0601 was Chris LeBlanc from The Podcast Station. You can check them out at thepodcaststation.com. And thank you very much, Chris, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, recently we had Valentine's Day, which I like to refer to as Hallmark Propaganda Day, but that's a story for another time. Folks who live in Nash County, North Carolina, had a potential special way to celebrate Valentine's Day. According to the Facebook post, for the opportunity too sweet to pass up, this weekend special starts off with a set of limited edition platinum bracelets, free transportation with a chauffeur, a one-night minimum stay in our luxurious five-star accommodations, and this special offer is capped off with a special Valentine's dinner. To share this with a friend, lover, or, more appropriately, ex-lover, just call the sheriff's office with the location of someone with outstanding warrants. Well, the post went viral, with thousands of shares and hundreds of comments, and spread further when it was reposted by other law enforcement agencies. Well, if you read your history lore, this is actually a good connection to the actual St. Valentine's last days. Go ahead, Google it. A neighborhood in Bethpage, New York, is in an uproar after a number of residents got an anonymous letter in the mail. Take your Christmas lights down. It's Valentine's Day. One recipient, Sarah Pascucci, posted it on Facebook, noting that she's been quite distracted since her father and aunt died of COVID-19 in January. She said, "There's funeral arrangements, bills to take care of, and it's also very hard to take something down that your father enjoyed." One commenter asked the perpetrator, "Lights? That's your biggest problem right now? Lights?" Some of Sarah's neighbors that didn't get the letter are taking action. They're putting their Christmas lights back up to support her. That's kind of sweet. Unless, of course, this is all a psych out by the writer of the alleged anonymous letter, who is actually the power company who knew that this psychological warfare would result in people putting up more lights. Just a theory. Yeah. Clackamas County, Oregon Sheriff's deputy driving on the highway at about 11 p.m. noticed a car coming up behind him very quickly. The deputy pulled to the right lane to let the car pass. It did, at about 90 miles an hour. Once behind the VW Jetta, the deputy could read a large sticker on the back. It said, "Not drunk, avoiding potholes." And he pulled the car over for speeding. The deputy stopped about 25 feet behind the Jetta, which slowly rolled backward until it hit his patrol car. The car reeked of alcoholic beverages, and there was an open can of beer in the car's cup holder. The deputy found that 41-year-old Jeffrey D. Cannon was driving on a suspended license. Yes, they always are. Had a concealed pistol with the serial number removed, was a convicted felon not allowed to possess firearms, and had a big bag of cocaine. Oh, and he was drunk, too. His breath test showed 0.22%, which is nearly three times the legal limit. Cannon was arrested and booked into jail. Wow. A drunk driving, illegal gun-toting, felon carrying drugs, driving a Jetta with a bumper sticker saying, "Not drunk, avoiding potholes." Well, let's be optimistic and count the one positive here. At least he managed to avoid potholes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Robert J. Halleck of Chattanooga, Tennessee, was arrested February 11th and charged with perjury, forgery, and identity theft after applying for a handgun permit using former President Barack Obama's name.
Being president is never easy.
Oh, but that's not all.
It gets worse.
The arrest report also said his application included a letter with a United States of America seal and U.S. Department of State letterhead, along with a $50 check.
Some people are so dumb.
Truth. In November, Halleck had been denied a handgun permit under his own name due to an active warrant for his arrest in Michigan.
Now that's a legacy.
Word up. Mic drop time.
Obama out.
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in 2007, Melanie Lentz was a fresh-faced 22-year-old woman who became a member of the Secret Service. She was one of the youngest female agents ever hired in the historically male profession. She shares her story in the book Agent Innocent, How the Secret Service Changed My Life. Melanie joins us on the line from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, Peter. Nice to talk with you today.
Nice to talk with you as well. When you first joined the Secret Service, as we said, it was predominantly male-oriented. Were there any other female agents around?
Yeah, well, my academy class of 24 had three total female agents, me and two other women who were both a lot older than me and both had military or law enforcement experience, and one of them had both, actually. But the Secret Service actually didn't start hiring female agents until the early 70s. And even today, there's mostly a one female agent to every 9 or 10 male agents. So it's still, even today, very, very male-dominated occupation for sure.
At 22, I mean, you brought up a point about the others that were in at the time. At 22, you had no previous experience in any kind of law enforcement or military. Is that unusual in the Secret Service?
Yes, I would say there was probably only a couple other people in my class that maybe didn't, but they had something public service in their background. It was unusual. I was a kinesiology major. I was in grad school when I applied, so I was studying exercise science my grandpa had his best buddy's daughter was an agent. So they were always bragging on the daughter and stuff. And my grandpa said, well, you should apply, you know, you meet the minimum standard, you're 21 and you have a college degree, you know, why not? So I applied thinking, hey, that would be such a cool job, but you know, I'll probably never hear from them, but they did. They ended up calling. We had a written test we had to pass and I barely squeaked by. I had no experience. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. But I decided that, you know, I was a very driven, stubborn young lady and I was just not going to give them a reason not to hire me other than my age, that I was just going to work and work and work until I could do the job well. And apparently they liked that attitude and that go-getter mentality, but I was definitely, I mean, you can probably imagine, I looked about 16 when I was 22 years old. So that first day in the academy, I'd never lined up in formation and I'm surrounded by military haircuts and, you know, biceps. So you can imagine, you know, how much of a misfit I must have looked on that first day. So I definitely had a learning curve and I was just too stubborn to quit. I just worked until I got it right.
Well, you mentioned you didn't know what you were getting yourself into. Was there a point when you realized, wait a minute, I may be treading water here?
Yeah. You know what? There was a point during training where they would just get on me and on me about just not being assertive enough. You know, that command presence that you need to have as an agent, you have to have it to do your job. And I remember them getting on me really early in training. And we had a test coming up, one of our fighting tests. And they said, you have to got to get it together or you're not going to make it, you know. And I remember when it was my turn to go for this test, we had to fight another instructor and, you know, had a scenario. They looked at me like, and I knew they were doubting me. It's like they had their red pens clicked and they were ready to just, you know, document all my mistakes. They called, the test was on, and I fought my little heart out. And it was like this, that time it clicks, like, I can do this. I've got this. It was a turning moment for me in training that, yes, I don't fit the mold they're looking for, but I can do this. I have something to offer, and ended up acing the test. And not that it was easy from then on out, but it was that I proved something to myself that day that I could be assertive. I could yell loud. I could defend myself. I could defend someone else. And from then on forward, I knew I can do this. And I had proved to the instructors a lot too. You know, even they said in our debrief that, you know, you have it. Let's keep going. Don't lose that. So yeah, I guess in every young person's life, they've got to, you know, step up. And that was my moment. And I'm so grateful that I did.
Well, without getting into the political weeds, is there a process involved where either personality wise or even politically wise, you're matched up with somebody? In other words, would it be difficult to be on a detail with someone who you either didn't like or didn't get along with or didn't have some similar political views, or is that irrelevant?
Right. You know, and that's a fair question. You know, when I became a Secret Service agent, it was in 2007. So 2008 was a new campaign year. I didn't know who I was going to be protecting or, you know, a Secret Service agent's career is, you know, 25, you know, 30 years. So you're going to protect a lot of people in that time. Maybe somebody you didn't exactly vote for or align with politically. I think that anyone who becomes a Secret Service agent, I think deep down, they know that the office of the president or vice president and their families, those offices are important. And deep down as an American, you don't want the country to fail. No matter who's in office, I don't want the country to fail. And I know that maybe it's a meaningful, you have meaning in your life when you're an agent because you can be part of helping that not happen. That if something happened to the person in the office of the president, it would be a bad day for the country. And so I think you think keep that mentality as opposed to who that person is. Sometimes, you know, I didn't always protect the person I voted for or maybe somebody who I aligned with politically, but I got up and we did the job and tried to, you know, keep America at least, you know, stable in that regard, if that makes sense.
On the other side of the coin, is it a plus or a negative to actually get close personally to the person you're detailed to?
Right. Well, I spent a lot of my time in Los Angeles. And so my field time, an agent gets out of training and they go to the field. So in Los Angeles, we had a lot of foreign heads of state that came into the country. So there was never a shortage of protection assignments to people that I wouldn't have protected otherwise. It was just because they were visiting the state. They got Secret Service protection. But my assignment was with former First Lady Nancy Reagan. So I left the job after she passed away in 2016. So it's been a few years since I've been an agent. And I will tell you, I never had a really much of a personal conversation with my protectee. It was all business. And granted, she was elderly then in her 90s. So we weren't traveling like some of the details with younger protectees. But I think that in general, you don't get super close, but you're so privy to so much of their lives, the very human side of them, because you're with them all the time. So it's kind of an interesting relationship that most of the time you aren't personally close, but you know a lot of personal things. But yeah, it's kind of a weird relationship to have with somebody that you're responsible for their lives. Yeah, it's a weird mentality for an agent to have, I think, but we do it.
You know, there's especially when you're dealing with political families, they're just that, they are families. Have you ever been involved in the detail where you were protecting someone's children? And does that sometimes feel akin to babysitting?
Oh, yeah. Well, I know for temporary assignments, I did. There was one time one of the Obama daughters came out to California, and I was a rescue swimmer for the Secret Service, one of very few females to pass that course. And so anytime a protectee would want to go to the beach or go into the swimming pool, they would call a rescue swimmer to kind of be on site, you know, basically like a lifeguard. And so I remember a couple times when somebody would come into town, specifically one of the Obama daughters, I was at the pool for that. So yeah, it was kind of like babysitting, but you know, it was all in a day's work. It was kind of, sometimes they're kind of fun when you have the kids.
You mentioned there still isn't a lot of women in the Secret Service. Have you written this book partially to tell your story and also to maybe guide others coming up behind you who might think that this is a job for them, or worse yet, think that this is not a job for them?
Yes. My book is, you know, a lot of agents that leave the job, they write this big tell-all with all the scandal and such. And my story is a little bit different in that I chose to write the story about the personal life. Being an agent is a very tough job, as many jobs are in your personal life. I traveled a lot. I started out so strong as a 22-year-old. I wanted to live a meaningful life and do big things. And I said yes to work and no to my family, no to my loved ones, no to a lot of things I could have said yes to. And I crashed and burned. When Nancy Reagan passed away, I was the agent in the embalming room with her, and I got to be a pallbearer at her family funeral. Now, if those two events will not make you contemplate your life a lot, I don't know what will. But at the time, I was going through a divorce. I was extremely depressed because of all of that stuff going on in my life, and I ended up leaving the job and starting over. And so my message is, A, I had to do a lot of growing up in the Secret Service and learn a lot of tough life lessons. But as I reflect back, so many elements of protection are so relevant to our personal lives. We just neglect to see them. And if I had protected myself better back then and been a little more self-aware, did my own little threat assessments and self-assessments, I would hope I wouldn't have made those same mistakes. You know, you always look back, you know, here are all the things I wish I knew before I became an adult. And so that's kind of the stuff I wrote about in my book, the underlying personal story and a lot of the funny stories. I mean, my goodness, you throw a 22-year-old into a Secret Service and there's going to be some comedy. Let me tell you, I'd never been in a fight in my life, you know, all this stuff. So I tell those stories, but the underlying message is one, I hope a positivity, and I hope that people who read the book will kind of say, hey, you know what? Some of those elements of protection that she's talking about are applicable in my life. Maybe I need to revisit where I'm going and keep track of making sure I'm headed in a direction always that is making me a better person, somebody I'm proud to be. And I unfortunately became somebody as an agent I wasn't proud to be. I was a workaholic who wasn't around for my family. You know, the job will replace you in 2 seconds, but my family was still there and I had neglected them a lot. So that's kind of more of the story I'm telling in my book. And I hope it's motivational and uplifting to people and, you know, maybe get a few laughs out of my blunders too as well.
So what are you doing now besides promoting this book?
Yeah, I write and I do a lot of keynote speaking, and I found the younger crowd. So I've been doing a lot of high school and college speaking to small groups there. And speaking to at women's events, I had a keynote speaking gig at a women's health summit last year before all the COVID stuff happened. And I've really found that I enjoy, the more I talk about it, the more I found people relate to it, and it is helping to talk about it and kind of bring some things to the forefront, specifically just being depressed or mental health in law enforcement, seeing some tough things on the job. And so I'm doing that a lot, working on a second book and just doing a lot of writing and speaking in that regard. So yeah, the book came out in 2019. And so I've been proud of it and, you know, kind of looking for what's next. What else? There's more to my story. That's the beauty of memoir, right? I'm writing it and there's still more to come. And so I'm excited to start sharing that in the second book and moving forward with life in a direction that I'm proud to be in. And yeah, I'm very blessed that I learned so much at such a young age about being an adult and being a better person.
The book is Agent Innocent. Melanie, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Melanie Lentz, author of Agent Innocent, How the Secret Service Changed My Life. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0601, and you'll find links to Melanie's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Dennis Palumbo about writers during COVID-19. Plus, Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back with his once-a-month visit. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File Program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few, and several radio stations that continue to play The Stuff File Program, such as WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, WLSL LPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories, just to name a few. Thanks muchly for all of you taking part in playing and listening to the Stuff File program. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? It's not unusual for someone to discover some loose change in a couch, but not this. Emergency responders were called to a Kansas home where a surprise resident found a 6-foot snake hiding inside their couch. Firefighters responded to assist the Rose Hill Police Department with the unusual call. A resident reported finding a large boa constrictor hiding inside their couch. The resident said they had lived in the duplex for 4 years and wasn't aware of any missing snakes in the neighborhood. Police and firefighters said they do not know where the snake came from, and they are hoping the apparent escaped pet's owner will come forward. See, this is why I never sleep on couches. And have you ever complained about the snow removal in your area? How far would you go to get that job done? Bet you wouldn't go this far. A Ukrainian man has reported a fictitious murder to police in the hope that they would clear snow from his road when they came to arrest him. The man called police on Saturday night to tell them that he had killed his mother's partner by stabbing him. The man also advised police to bring a snowplow because it was not possible to reach his house otherwise. Law enforcement officers were, however, able to reach the property in the small village in northwestern Ukraine using an all-terrain vehicle. The alleged victim was safe and sound, and no one had attacked him. The road in question had been cleared of snow in the morning, according to local authorities, but the man said he was unhappy with the work and he had hoped that the police would finish the job. You know, wouldn't it be a fitting punishment if his sentence were to shovel out his neighborhood by hand? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, A Florida woman stabbed her sister with an EpiPen as the two were drinking together because she's allergic to drunks. Police said they responded to the home of 62-year-old Joanna Zielinski. It's a home she shares with her sister, Laura. They arrived at around 10:30 p.m. on February the 11th due to a 911 call that was hung up. Laura told officers that they had been drinking together, and at some point she got tired and wanted to go to sleep, while Joanna stayed up and continued drinking. Records show that Laura said Joanna went crazy and attacked her with an EpiPen, stabbing her multiple times, including on her left thigh where a welt had formed. When asked about the incident, police said Joanna replied, "I'm allergic to drunks, so I injected her with the EpiPen so that she wouldn't be drunk anymore. What's the big deal?" First responders arrived on scene and said Laura wasn't actually injected with any medication during the incident because of the way Joanna was holding the EpiPen. The EpiPen was prescribed to Joanna, but her sister doesn't have any allergies. Laura said Joanna had been violent toward her in the past, and she wanted to press charges. Joanna was arrested on a battery domestic violence charge. So, according to first responders, no actual medicine was injected during the assault. Gee, that could lead to a debate as to what's worse, assaulting someone with an EpiPen, not knowing how to inject someone properly with an EpiPen in the case of an actual emergency, or thinking that an EpiPen is a cure-all and not knowing the difference between anaphylaxis and alcoholism. Yikes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Fans of this show already know that Dennis Palumbo was one of my favorite writers. He's the author of the Dr. Daniel Rinaldi series of thrillers. In addition to being a world-class writer, Dennis, like his main character, is also a psychotherapist, and he specializes in his practice of working with writers and other creative types. Now, recently, he wrote a piece about how said types are dealing with working during this pandemic, and it was an interesting read. So, Dennis joins us once again on the line from California. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. You know, I get the opportunity to talk to a lot of writers and actors and creative types, musicians. And of late, one of the things I've asked a lot of them is how they're getting through the pandemic. Here is a situation where you're writing about people who actually come to you and discuss this on a regular basis because you're their therapist. Have you noticed an increase in either anxiety on the one side with people who are having difficulty writing or being creative in this time period, and the other side of the coin who almost see the lockdown as a blessing to get things done?
Well, actually, as you described it, is how it is. Surprisingly, you know, over the years, I've had so many patients say to me, "Boy, if I ever just had some time off, I would sit down and write my magnum opus, you know, my special screenplay or that novel I've always wanted to write." And yet, since the lockdown, they've been paralyzed and have not written anything due to a number of factors. Number one, the anxiety about the pandemic and the uncertainty. And people handle uncertainty in different ways. For some people, they sort of catastrophize the future and think, wow, it's always going to be this way. But on the other hand, I have writers who have found that their workload is increased. They actually enjoy the constriction of the lockdown because they get a lot more time to do their work. Now, there's a third rail to this, which is if you're a writer with a family, children, a spouse, you're not getting to go to an office or go anywhere else to work. And so family obligations, all being under the same roof, impinge upon you, even if you have a desire to write. So, like all of us, writers are dependent on the context. And if your context is filled with family obligations and you don't get to escape to an office every day for 8 hours, you may be inclined to write, but unable to. So there are many different permutations. There's not a one-size-fits-all way that creative people are responding to the pandemic.
You just mentioned that with lockdown, writers don't have a place to go. And I think we mentioned in the past when you were on this program that before you were a therapist, you were also a screenwriter. You also co-wrote one of my favorite films, My Favorite Year. So when it comes to screenwriters, there's always that theory. There's always that that aspect that, oh, screenwriters, they just spend their days in coffee shops with their laptops writing, and that's something they can't even do.
Well, that's the point. Most screenwriters either have an office at home or have an office elsewhere or work at a coffee shop. But even if you have an office at home, most of the time your kids, if you have children, are away at school. If they're in lockdown with you, they knock on the door of your office. Or your spouse says, hey, come and take out the trash. So it doesn't feel like you have the isolation and solitude necessary to do the work. For those of my patients who do like going to coffee shops or even libraries to work, they can't leave their house. Those places are closed. And so even if you're the most introverted of writers, and most writers are pretty introverted, the constriction when it comes from the outside can be very, very dispiriting. Even the most introverted person likes to know he can go down the street and talk to the baristas at Starbucks. Well, if you can't do that, your introversion no longer feels like a character aspect of you. It feels like you're in prison. So the thing about lockdown primarily, and this is again where I move into the idea that there's no one size that fits all. It's what is the meaning you give to the lockdown? If you give it a negative meaning like, oh my God, what a disaster, it will always be this way, life will never be normal again, then you're going to be prone to depression that could be very debilitating, or equally debilitating kind of anxiety because of the uncertainty. And I think that those two things, depression and anxiety, were exacerbated. I don't want to get political, but I'm going to. Mm-hmm. Were exacerbated by the feeling that the Trump administration was not handling any of it very well and was helping to reinforce the idea that the pandemic was a hoax. So you also were dealing with the fact that people around you weren't taking it seriously.
So for those who are able to write, who are getting through this process by writing copious amounts, have you found that the situation we are all living in is infusing what they write?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the debates among most creative people is, with the projects that we're doing now, do we mention COVID? Do we mention the pandemic? And even if they don't, there's the sense of isolation and vulnerability and uncertainty about the world moving forward that I think has begun to infiltrate people's ideas. Their characters and their stories are now more, in my experience, just from what my patients tell me, more fraught with the idea of vulnerability to the world, a sense of uncertainty about the future, more than I've seen before. So even if you don't mention COVID in, let's say, a script you're working on now or a book you're working on now, your characters are talking more about how uncertain everything is, or you better live in the moment because you don't know what might happen, or the world seems to be going out of control. So there's a lot of, I think, metaphoric mentions of the feelings attached to the pandemic.
Under the old heading of physician, heal thyself, how has this whole situation affected you and your writing?
Well, it's affected me in the sense that, number one, it was a brutal year, 2020, in terms of being a therapist, because my patients were going through a lot of distress over this. And so I had to contain a lot of that. And so what it's done, I think, is it's muted some of my energy to write. In other words, at the end of the day, I just rather binge watch something stupid on Netflix just to shut my mind down a little bit. But in the last 3 or 4 months, I feel like, I don't know whether it was the announcement of the vaccines or, you know, I just got my first shot, that I'm starting to pick up again. I think that desultory quality that kind of seemed to infuse me, certainly in most of 2020, because of the, you know, work with my patients, I think some of that has begun to lift.
Well,
and I'm very appreciative of that.
Well, on a totally selfish note, the last Dr. Daniel Rinaldi book was Head Wounds, that came out in 2018. Dennis, we are waiting. When is the next one?
The next one will be in September of this year.
Ah!
It's called Panic Attack, and it will be the sixth version in the Daniel Rinaldi series.
Excellent. Will you come back on the show when it comes out?
Of course. Nothing like shameless self-promotion. I'm all over that. So I'm all in on any kind of blatant self-promotion. So I'd love to come on your show.
And on a more serious note, when it comes to therapy, you know, there are various trains of thought within the general population. There are those who believe that therapy is like going for a checkup at a doctor's. You don't wait for something to happen. You go in for regular checkups. There are those who don't believe in going to a doctor until something has gone wrong, an injury of some kind. Your thoughts on that? I'm assuming you're in the former category, in that people should see therapists on a regular basis, whether they're feeling great or not.
Well, yeah, that I tend to be supportive of therapy. I've been doing it for 30 years as a clinician, but I also don't think that, again, that there's one thing. I mean, I remember a patient terminating therapy and saying, you know, I get more out of my massage therapist than I do from you. So the point is it's not for everybody. The people for whom it works tend to do it consistently. I think to look at therapy just as symptom relief, like, oh, I don't sleep at night, I'm going to go see a therapist. Once that's taken care of, I'm leaving. There are people who do that, and that's totally fine. But one of the things about my practice is, since I specialize in creative people, on the whole, they tend to be self-reflective and interested in their inner workings, interested in living an examined life. And so it's not symptom-based. It's pretty much they need the support and are curious and interested in their inner world of experience. And there are people who are, and there are people who are not. So I'm a therapist who doesn't believe it's for everyone, but I do believe that when it's a good connection between a patient and a therapist, it could be life-changing for a person.
Dennis, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program, and I'm really excited to hear that you're going to have a new Dr. Daniel Rinaldi's book coming out later this year. When it does come out, you say it's called Panic Attack?
It's called Panic Attack.
Panic Attack. We look forward to when that comes out. In the meantime, people can read the previous five, the last one being Head Wounds, which are all great reads. Dennis, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure. And if there's anyone interested in my books, they can always check out my website, DennisPalumbo.com, and you can read about the five books and also my earlier career.
Excellent. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me, Peter. I really appreciate your support.
Dennis Palumbo, a psychotherapist who is also a screenwriter and novelist. His thriller series contains five Dr. Daniel Rinaldi novels, with a sixth one coming out this fall. He was also the co-writer of one of my favorite films, My Favorite Year, starring Peter O'Toole. And I gotta mention this very quickly. There was a period when I didn't have time for recreational reading, and I let that lapse. I've always said that if you want to get into reading again, you should grab a book that is an anthology of stories rather than one long novel. Well, back in 2008, when I first discovered Dennis's work as a mystery writer, I read his anthology of short stories called From Crime to Crime. What a fantastic read. It jump-started my love for reading again, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0601, and you'll find the links to Dennis's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order all of the books I've just mentioned. Plus, I've also put in a link to the article that he wrote that we were talking about in the first place. Enjoy. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com will be on the show. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way and a few more Stuff File news stories. Here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. 18-year-old Nicholas DeBettis was finally placed in handcuffs in Titusville, Florida on January 14th, after Brevard County officers chased him as he drove at an extremely high rate of speed to his mother's trailer. DeBettis had a unique excuse. "If I would have tried to stop quicker, I would have crashed the vehicle," he told police. He went on to say that his mother wanted him home for an unknown reason. DeBettis had an outstanding warrant and was driving a stolen Hyundai Elantra. Well, driving a stolen car in a hurry to get to his mommy's trailer. Doesn't this have the ring of Dukes of Hazzard to it? Yeah. And finally, an Ohio man is marking the Christian tradition of Lent by giving up solid foods for 46 days and getting the majority of his sustenance from beer. Del Hall of Cincinnati said his Lent diet includes only beer, water, black coffee, and herbal tea. And as of his Friday morning weigh-in, which was day 3 of his diet, he was down 5.8 pounds. "I only have 3 to 5 beers a day," Hall said. "It's not like I'm drinking constantly. If you eat your standard diet, it gets boring. You don't eat the same thing every day, so I'm definitely not going to drink the same thing every day." Hall said he successfully completed Lent beer diets in 2019 and 2020, each time noticing health benefits of the experience. He said he lost 40 to 50 pounds both years and noticed his blood pressure and cholesterol improved. Well, I'm guessing he also, after Lent, gained back the 40 to 50 pounds. Either that or he's dwindling away year by year. Anyway, Hall is raising money through a crowdfunding initiative dubbed Sergeant Dell's Virtual Tip Jar. He said the money will go toward local bars and restaurants that have suffered losses due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, I believe day 47 will be called an intervention. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars and the curator of the website WeirdHistorian.com, is back for his monthly visit featuring a weird moment in history for the current month. So, here we are racing through February. Mark joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. So, we are indeed racing through February, aren't we?
We are. Racing, it's a great race.
A great race. It's one of my favorite movies, by the way, but this is not the movie. This is the real thing.
We're going to talk about the Great Race of 1908, which took place, well, it started, I should say, in February 12th, 1908. And this was really quite a race. It was going from New York City to Paris, so around the world. And this was going to start in Times Square. Keep in mind, it's 1908. So cars are pretty much in their infancy still. And it was going to be a 20,000-mile route. So we're heading west.
Well, never mind cars being in their infancy. Roads were in their infancy.
Yes, for sure. There were not that many roads, which added to the challenge. This is such an incredible feat. So there was, we'll paint the picture a little bit of what was going on. So start in Times Square. That was the takeoff point, right? There's six vehicles that were participating. There were three of them from France. There was one from Italy, one from Germany, and there was one from America, which was the Thomas Flyer car. So this Thomas Flyer car was a 1907 model. It was a four-cylinder, 60 horsepower, and it was capable of reaching 60 miles per hour, which was probably pretty good at that time. But, you know, 60 horsepower. That's all we're talking here.
Yeah, so basically from 0 to 60 in a lifetime.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. and so this car, so, you know, they loaded up some supplies, of course, for this journey. So this particular car had two shovels with them. They had a couple of picks, a couple lanterns, some searchlights, two extra gas tanks. And each gas tank could hold 10 gallons. They had a bunch of rope. They had a rifle and revolvers in case, you know, ran into some, I guess, some trouble. And this is really important. It had an attachable top, like something used on a covered wagon, because cars didn't have tops yet. This was not like an innovation that vehicles had in 1908. The other thing it didn't have was a windshield. So you can imagine, knowing that it had no top and no windshield, and I just remind what I just said, this was February in New York.
Yes.
So not off to an awesome start.
Now, when people say, we're going to drive from New York to Paris, common knowledge would have people say, well, wait a minute. Aren't there a couple of oceans between any way you can get there?
Yeah, exactly. So what they were going to do, they were going to drive west until they got to the Pacific. And then the thought was, so there were a couple things they could do. One was they were going to try to head up towards Alaska, go across the Bering Strait, and then go into Siberia. Or they would take, if they had to, they would take a steamer across to get them to Russia, basically.
And again, as you say, getting to Siberia in a race that is planned for February.
Yeah. So they started off cold and they were going to head toward colder.
Yeah.
great time for a race, right? Let's do it in February. So again, you know, like you mentioned, there were hardly any roads, you know, in America really at that time. And so when the race started that morning of the 12th, the whole field of six narrowed pretty quickly. One of the cars only got as far as Peekskill, New York, and it broke down. That was it, right? Another one got as far as Iowa, and then its mechanical problems. That was it for that car. But the others kept going. At one point, this Thomas car, the American, you know, our hero, the American car, took 13 hours just to go 8 miles through the snow in Indiana. I mean, I can't even imagine the patience of these guys. We got to keep going, right? And in cases where there were no roads, they would get, if there were train tracks available, they would just drive over the train tracks. So they would find the way. So anyway, the Thomas car, it finally gets to San Francisco. It took over 41 days to get there. And then it took this ship to Alaska. But then it was the conditions were just too poor at that point to continue on. So it was sent back to Seattle. And then it was rerouted to across the Pacific to Japan. So it got some help along across the ocean. And then from there, it took another ship after it went across Japan into Siberia. So you know, it's holding up pretty well. I mean, these guys are really persevering. So in the meantime, they get to Siberia. And Siberia, as you can imagine, was not a great place to drive either. Also, a few roads, like you mentioned. The weather is pretty poor. It's pretty bad. And they had other just things to overcome. The culture there was a little bit different. They didn't know how to respond to people. They ran into mosquitoes that were horrific, just mosquitoes attacking them. And they had mud. So not only the snow, but they had mud. It took them, in one case, it took 4 days to go 60 miles through the mud.
And let's be honest, it's 1908. The entire world wasn't exactly a friendly place at that time.
Right. And so, you know, they didn't know what they were going to encounter. In fact, at one point, they thought they were under attack just because, again, of cultural differences of people sort of rushing at them.
But then they actually did turn out to be friendly observers. So, but they didn't know, you know, because, you know, we don't know what people are like at this point. So fortunately, it got through all this mud and it got through the amazingly, it got through the weather. I mean, it really is remarkable that these guys in the car, and it was a main driver with a couple guys helping out, a helper and a mechanic was with them, of course, to, you know, take care of any issues that might come up, which, of course, would. But they really, it's really amazing that these guys lived. So they got through Siberia, then they get into Europe and they drive across Europe, which is, again, looking pretty good, right? So then by July 30th, weather's getting better at this point, right? We're into summer because it's now been 169 days of travel. The Thomas car makes its way into Paris. So it's right there at the finish line, right? We're there. But then they run into another obstacle, one that they almost didn't overcome. And that was they got stopped by a police officer because the car, after 169 days of horrific travel, no longer had a working headlight. And the law said, if you don't have a headlight, you cannot proceed. That's it. You can't continue on the road. So they almost got foiled by a cop in Paris for a bad headlight after everything. But they lucked out because there was a bicyclist who watched the whole thing. And he had a functioning headlight on his bicycle. So he loaded the bike onto the car. And then the officer let them pass.
Wow.
So, you know, they made it. So by 6 o'clock on July 30th, the Thomas car, the American Thomas Flyer, completed the race. Now, it actually wasn't the first car to complete the race. One of the other cars had gotten there 4 days earlier. But it had received a 15-day penalty because it got a little help going across about half of America getting transported as opposed to driving. So they were penalized 15 days, and that gave the Thomas Flyer the victory.
So sort of like the Rosie Ruiz of early races.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is just an incredible story that they could complete this and that they wanted to do this. I mean, I don't know what the appeal was to go 20,000 miles and with no roads and no top to the car, no windshield.
So how many cars started and how many cars finished?
So there were six that started, three finished. So that I mentioned the one that came in, got there the earliest, but was penalized. So did not win. And then there was a third car that made it to Paris, but it took another month until it got there.
Another month.
But wow. They persevered, you know. They might not have gotten many reports about what was going on, again, given the fact it was 1908.
Now, again, I love the movie The Amazing Race, which is a comedy loosely based on this, but nowhere fact-based, but loosely based. They decided at the end, spoiler alert, to turn around and do a race from Paris to New York. I'm assuming that didn't happen in this race.
No, they were done. They got, in fact, they kind of had to be done because once they finished, people were excited. Obviously, I'm sure the Parisians were thrilled to see this race actually completed, and so people sort of, ran to the car and took souvenirs. So they took some treads of its tires, like cut off a piece of the tire, just pulled a few pieces of the car here and there, and then a bunch of people signed the car as well. Just want to, have a connection to it in some way. So it's actually that what's left of the car is still available to be seen at the National Automobile Museum in Reno, Nevada. And so if anyone wants to go see it, it would be a pretty easy drive by their standards.
Stripped down.
It's just like a hop, skipping away pretty much from anyone on this continent.
Stripped down like a car abandoned in the wrong part of Chicago.
Yeah. But I mean, what an incredible race that these guys did, and again, I I hate driving. Like a few hours is wears me out. I don't know how these guys had the stamina to go 20,000 miles with the conditions and the lack of power that those vehicles had back then.
Yeah, and your mileage may vary. another fascinating story, Mark. Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars. His website is weirdhistorian.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0601, and you'll find links to Mark's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Remember last week when we told you the story of Tessica Brown, the woman who gorilla glued her hair to her scalp? Well, this is the one time in all the years I've been doing this that an idiot of the day begets another idiot of the day. As you know, Tessica used Gorilla Glue as hairspray. A month later, it took a surgeon 4 hours to remove the goo. But Len Martin, also from Tessica's state of Louisiana, doubted her predicament as serious. And to prove how easy it would be to remove the glue, he used Gorilla Glue to stick a plastic cup to his own lip. He figured he could lick it off. But couldn't remove it no matter what he tried to do. He went to the emergency room where a doctor removed it via some painful peeling. I'm also assuming the entire medical staff laughed when he walked in with a cup stuck to his lip. Worse, part of his lip was damaged enough that if it doesn't heal well, the doctor said, it would have to be surgically removed. In a statement, the glue company pointed out that their warning label clearly states, do not swallow, do not get in eyes or skin or on clothing. Yeah, well, here is another warning. A good percentage of people who actually read warning labels still don't follow the directions. After all, why would someone gorilla glue a plastic cup to their own lip to prove a point? Well, there are one of two reasons. Either they want to start an all-new league and interesting version of beer pong, or they're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0601. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0601. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. The Stuff File reminds you never try to drown your sorrows. They'll just learn to swim anyway.